Blog Talk Radio.
And it's Tuesday, March the 15th, 2016. And once again, we bring you the latest news analysis, the latest announcements, and an up-to-date report on the death camps and the death prisons in America. This is the Ralph Pointer What's Happening program, and without further ado, this is Betty Davis turning the mic over to Ralph Pointer. Brother Ralph in the house.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. And when I say brothers and sisters, I mean those few people among us who are willing to have an open and honest discussion about the issues, come to a conclusion, and whatever their conclusion is, work on what they think the answers are. And at the end of the day, at the end of the month, at the end of the year, those who have been correct consistently must be recognized as being correct consistently, and those who are incorrect consistently must also be recognized as that. Now, what I believe, the overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because of our heroes, the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people. Our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. And I'm going to read that last sentence again in case anybody missed it. Because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. And this evening, when we see there may be a high point or it may even be a low point, depending on your attitude toward the electoral process, I think one of the things we must do at this moment in history is talk about what is happening today in America and what has been happening. That is, if you don't understand the past, if you don't recognize the problems of the past, you are likely to make mistakes for in the future. And I can see all of those pundits and all of those past government officials talking about free and fair elections in Syria and around the world. Never, never, never talk about the fact that they have never had free and fair elections in America. Excuse. Anyway, I would like to remind people of the terror and the violence around that surrounds the question of blacks voting. We all know about the Civil War, 1865. We know the 15th Amendment gave black men the right to vote on a piece of paper. But we know it was 1965 before black people even attempted to vote. And if you went to vote before that, you could be lynched. Many a person was lynched. Many a person was driven out of their community. Fannie Lou Hamer. You got to study the story of Fannie Lou Hamer if you want to know anything about voting in America. And about the government position, we know that's the government's domestic policy on voting. They did not support the right to vote for ex-slaves. That is another story. We will not get into it tonight, but we know that story. I believe everyone does. And if you talk about that, I heard some pundits, ex-State Department officials say today, we have never seen this type of violence in an election. And I laughed. I laughed out loud. One black guy gets punched, and I'm saying, and another scuffle took place. And I say no one was lynched, no one was tarred and feathered, no one was run out of town, no group of police. Remember the day of the bridge in Birmingham when the police came out with their dogs, fire hoses, whipped everybody. It was about the vote, the right to people of color to express themselves. And so we see the pundits are going to ignore the history of America. And I can't talk about the violence of the history of America without mentioning the indigenous people who existed on this land before Europeans got here. And I always say the one group of people who got it in the neck worse than black people, and it has to be the indigenous people, they are still being oppressed. We are still being oppressed, but we're alive to continue to be oppressed until we make changes. Now, the success of American democracy, well, we all know what it is. If you get free land, took genocide to get that. That's the death of the American Indians. And we have the free labor. Well, that leaves very little room for failure. And then on top of that, we go on with imperialism. What imperialism means is you go around the world taking other people's resources and bringing them back to America, and the rich take the lion's share. And when we talk about taking the resources, how do they take resources? One of the ways they do it is they kill leaders, democratically elected leaders, and put in their flunkies, paid flunkies. They send the CIA and army to support these paid flunkies, and therefore they take other countries' resources, and as for their interest in democratically elected officials or supporting democratically elected governments, it is a sad joke. And one day we'll have to have the program based on Iran, when Mossadegh was duly elected as president and the American government overthrew him and put in the Shah. And the list goes on and on and on through Africa, through South America, Allende, Pinochet, and up to today, where, as Glenn Ford says it, we people of color are being destroyed by the misleadership class he refers to when he talks about the black so-called politicians. As Fannie Lou Hamer said it best, we were ready. We, the people, were ready for freedom and democracy, but the loyalist black Democrats were not. Now, as you know, I could go on and on and on, but I will not this evening because we have very serious issues to talk about. Brother Larry, Sister Lynn, I'm going to skip over and go to Lynn tonight for a reason that she will tell you why. Lynn, are you there? Lynn, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me, Ralph?
I can hear you. It scared me for a minute, but go ahead and talk about
why.
Okay,
these, as I said last week, these newfangled headphones and machines are sometimes a little beyond me. But anyway, as long as I'm broadcasting, I'm happy.
Okay.
Yes, I have.
Thank you.
Okay, I wanted to talk first of all about the terrible loss we suffered this week, and I include the entire audience because I think we've all been caught up in the push that this program and indeed our movement must make to free political prisoners. And one of the most important, well, I can't say most important, that's not fair. He was a standout among all the political prisoners, and I mean Mondo, whose poems of exploration I have been reading ever since this program got on the air. And Mondo passed away this week. Apparently he had been ill for some time and was unable to draw breath, and so he died in a prison in Lincoln, Nebraska. And as his friend and his champion, Michael Richardson, a journalist, said, the tragedy is he went from the jail to the grave. He did not ever get home. And that is our charge, and that is our mourning. We mourn Mondo. We mourn him, and we mourn for all of those who are facing such an inevitability. And I was reading over his poems and his book again. Don't forget, you can get that. The Black Panther is an African Cat. Mm-hmm. Fabulous book of poetry and art. And he had written, when he was first in jail, Mondo, he said he turned himself in to the police, and he turned himself in because he knew he was innocent. And he wrote, I had faith in you, the people, that you would be able to see political persecution for what it is. I had faith that you would be able to see through the window dressing public officials would go through to disguise the move to silence two outspoken men. And I have been called a fool for having such faith. Ed, that's his co-defendant, has been called likewise by those who do not believe there is such a thing as power of the people. Well, I know there is power of the people. I know it because it brought me home. It brought me home after my good and faithful husband, Ralph Pointer, and friend Betty Davis went to such great lengths to make it happen. It didn't work for Mondo, and it reminds me of Mutulu Shakur wrote to us. He said, there is no greater faith than that which the political prisoner has that the movement will bring him home. It is greater than any religion. And we, sadly, have not been living up to that. We must do better. Ed Poindexter, remains in jail in Nebraska, still framed up just as Mondo was, still getting on in years. We need to bring Ed home. We need to bring Mutulu home. Remember last week I spoke about Mutulu's new campaign. Mutulu Shakur is welcome here. I would say all 150 of the so-called political prisoners can knock on my door any time they want. The doors are open to them. And I hope you all feel the same, and you will make it your number one priority to get them home. And I would like to enjoin everybody, and I know that this is asking a lot, but if you can, you should, in this year of elections, everything is politics. You can't turn on your TV or your radio without hearing about the political gymnastics going on. All of the Congress will be reelected. If you have that interest, if that is your thing, if you believe in these electoral politics and the people we elect, demand, make the demand, as Frederick Douglass would say, make the demand that they bring home our political prisoners, these brave, long-suffering people who are doing time for all of us. It just isn't fair, and we must take up this fight. And while I'm on that subject of taking up the fight, I just want Ralph to bring to everybody's attention that this is a year of many anniversaries. We talked about the Panthers' 50th. We talked about Larry Davis, the 30th anniversary. But it's the 10th anniversary of a group of women who are famous for their slogan, "We will not be silenced." The women in black, we've all seen them at demonstrations. They dress in black. They carry signs that are black with white lettering. The last demo I was at, where, which was up at the Grand Central Terminal, where we all carried signs carrying the names of someone who had died at the hands of the police. They are celebrating, if you can call it that, their 10th anniversary. They have been out here for 10 years, not being silent, fighting about against inequality and violence of the police and foreign policy. On Friday, March 18th, that's this Friday, 6:30 p.m., the new Whitney Museum, downtown in the meat market, 99 Gansevoort Street, the Whitney Museum at 6:30, Women in Black are sponsoring a museum visit. We are going to all go into the museum to view the Loras Poitras exhibition. Laura, if you're not familiar, is the woman who protected Ed Snowden, who was on the plane with him while they read through his amazing tape. Laura was one of the people who was there and who aided him and aided all of us in bringing forth what our spy network was doing to the citizenry of this country. Then on Saturday, as part of this 10-year celebration, they are going to celebrate something they call No Allegiance to Endless Bloodshed. And they will demonstrate, and we will be there, of course, at the World Trade Center, Liberty Street in Greenwich, at 10 o'clock. And the message is, grief has no borders, love has no borders. And from there, they are traveling to the military recruitment station in Times Square, where they will meet up with the War Resisters League, who are also demonstrating on Saturday at around 1 p.m. We will not be silent. Activists, Artists, Collaborative Language Project has been in existence and is one of the very best, the most trustworthy. Join us. Be with them. March 18th at the Whitney Museum on Gansevoort Street at 6:30, free admission to the museum, and again at the World Trade Center on Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, liberty, and I think I said liberty and Greenwich. Yes, liberty and Greenwich. Please join. These are important things to remember. And with that, I want to say the struggle doesn't end. We keep on going. We do not falter. We do not fall. We pick up the banner and march on. Thank you, Ralph.
Well, thank you, Lynn. And I'm going to turn it back over to Betty.
We hope you'll hang in there, Sister Lynn, because we are looking forward to some of the poetry that you always share with us. I want to acknowledge that Sister Ann Lamb is in the house, and that our stalwart warrior, Larry Pinckney, is in the house, and our Sister Mary Neal is in the house. At this time, I want to call on Brother Larry. He sent out a wonderful message concerning our brother, Mondo. Those of you who don't know, Larry is a member of the Black Commentator. He's also a member of the editor of the Black Writers Guild. And it's interesting to quote him because a couple of years ago he said, "It is no mere coincidence that Democratic Party Republicrat Barack Obama had the unheard of amount of approximately $600 million in his political campaign coffers, compared with fellow Republican Party Republicrat John McCain's approximately $100 million campaign coffer dollars. This fact alone should give some crucial insight into the despicable financial role played by corporations." And I won't finish the quote. I will simply turn it over to Brother Larry.
And I must say that when Lynn opened up and said that there was faith in the people to get her out, I would be very remiss if I didn't talk about Brother Larry Pinckney and his wonderful wife, Caroline, who did all kinds of work, and she did a map of the world, of a love map of those who supported Lynn. And I carried that around the country and put it up on posters whenever I had to, where I was speaking on behalf of Lynn. It was great work, and this is the type of effort we must have for all of our political prisoners. I could go on all night, but I will not. Larry, are you with us?
Yes, indeed, my brother. My love to you, love and strength, to Sister Betty Davis, and, of course, to our beloved Sister Lynn Stewart. Love to all three of you and everyone else on the show and all of our listeners. You know, you mentioned the map that Caroline put together. We, in fact, have it. Still, we intend to keep it hanging on the wall forever. It's hanging on the wall, and it's entitled Worldwide Love for Lynn Stewart. And on that map, as you indicated, Brother Ralph, oh, my God, the map is almost totally red because Caroline used red to show the countries that we were in contact with, where people have been supporting and coming out strongly in support of Sister Lynn Stewart. And, yes, I've got to say that I give kudos to that, to Caroline and to all of the folks who kept fighting. And we've got to keep fighting, you know, as everyone, I shouldn't say as everyone, as some may know, 2.5-3 weeks or so ago, one of our political prisoners, Albert Woodfox, finally was released after 4 decades in prison, most of which are in the Gulag, the prison Gulag torture system, most of which was spent, if you can believe it or not, in solitary confinement. I'm happy to report that I have been in touch with direct contact with people who are very close to Brother Albert, and I'm told last report, that was a couple of days ago when I spoke with some folks in Louisiana, the brother's doing well, or as well as can be hoped for and expected. All I can say is I'm amazed, but he's surrounded by good people. I mean, I spent 10 years as a political prisoner, and I got to tell you, I still suffer from that. I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that. I still have nightmares. I still deal with the brutality and the insanity that I directly experience as a political prisoner. But you know what? The struggle goes on. And examples such as Mondo and such as Herman Wallace, such as Robert King, such as Sister Lynn Stewart, such as Leonard Peltier, such as Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, I always talk about the horrors of the system, and I always quote Gil Scott Heron, the late Gil Scott Heron, when he said, you know, those horrors are an endless list that won't be missed. But one thing I need to also say is that our brothers and sisters, our sisters and brothers, our heroes and sheroes, guess what? They are an endless list, and we won't let them be missed because we're going to bring them home. That's what this struggle is about. There is no, I repeat, no candidate, quote unquote, in this sparse, S-A-R-C-E, of an election. No candidate in Babylon, also known as the United States, that we can support, and most particularly, as you said, Ralph, many times, I believe all of us have said it, Sister Lynn, Sister Betty, you know what? If you don't support our political prisoners, you don't support us, and we don't support you. So I can only say that I'm deeply saddened by Mondo's passing. Of course, as you may know, Brother Mondo was a veteran of the Black Panther Party, as is Ed Poindexter, who is still languishing in prison in Nebraska. But my point is that please understand that we've got to one day regain our humanity. One day, for God's sake, can't we regain our humanity? We're the only ones who can do it. People can't give you your freedom. You take your freedom. Freedom, as Curtis Mayfield used to say, freedom is not free. You take it. We have to take it. That's what libertad, liberation, is all about. And it's about love, as Ernesto Che Guevara said. That's what drives the revolutionary. It's love. Love for the people. Love for our brothers and sisters. So I'm going to stop. I'm going to remind everyone also about Reverend Edward Pinckney, who's still languishing in a Michigan prison. I want to remind folks, so I do want to say this before I get off, and that is that I did receive some information, and maybe others did too, from the Leonard Peltier committee, that they're going to be seeking clemency for Brother Leonard. So just be aware of that, and do what your heart tells you to do, okay? My own thoughts are we got to free our political prisoners, and we have to do it now, because at stake is not only their lives and dignity, but at stake, please understand, at stake are our lives and dignity. For example, when they had Lynn Stewart locked up, I was angry, and I wrote scathing articles that were published all over the world in exhorting people to take action. Don't sit back. This is you. This is not just Lynn. This is you. So I'm saying once again, on behalf of all of our political prisoners, sisters and brothers, this is you. This is us. Thanks again. All power to the people. Stay strong. Thank you, Ralph. Thank you, Betty. Thank you, Sister Lynn.
Thank you for that, Larry. And I must say, I was saddened, and I had never mentioned to you about what happened to the original poster of love that Caroline had made. And when I was carrying it around the country, I was in Washington, D.C., when Brother Perry Redd, who has a Blog Talk radio program there, said, "Ralph, we don't need any, what would you call, mementos of this movement. Everything in the movement is to be used to free our political prisoners." And I had some buttons that I wanted to save, buttons of Free Lynn Stewart. And he says, "Give them all out. You don't need to hold them." And while I was in Puerto Rico petitioning to free Lynn Stewart, some of the people in the Puerto Rican independence movement said, "Ralph, we want that poster. We want to duplicate it." And I said, "Gee, this is my personal poster. I will send it to the coffee shop." And they says, "No, we want the original." And
wow.
I said, "Okay." Perry Redd said, "There are no souvenirs of this movement. This movement has to, everything we do has to be an instrument of freeing our people." And so that original, I had 500 copies made, but the original is in Puerto Rico with the Puerto Rican independence movement. And I hope it is doing good there because they need it right now. They needed it yesterday. They've needed it all along to enlist people around the world to support their struggle of liberation, because this American octopus is strangling the people of Puerto Rico. And Caroline, thank you so much. It helped Lynn. I hope it's helping the people of Puerto Rico. I will not continue. I will turn this over to Betty, who will give us our next guest. Thanks, all. We can and we must do this. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. And Larry, as always, it is an honor to hear you speak. I want to now go to a tireless warrior for our political prisoners who never stops organizing, never stops visiting, never stops lecturing, never stops working for our political prisoners. Sister Ann Lamb. Sister Ann Lamb, are you in the house?
I am in the house, Sister Betty. Thank you so much. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I wish I was that powerful. Well, I do believe that we do have the power. We just have forgotten how to use it. Just still talking
a
little
bit. You are the power, Ann.
Yeah, well, we all are the power. Speaking a little bit about Mondo, I just wanted to let people know, because I just sent this out by email, is that he was sort of refusing. You know, his friends and supporters were saying, "Hey, let us try to get you out of here," you know, because he's been sick, you know. So I'm just going to read a little excerpt. "Friends and supporters had recently mounted a new effort to free Mondo. A dozen letters were written to the Nebraska Board of Pardons asking for a compassionate release because a 68-year-old man was slowly dying from end-stage COPD. A new defense attorney was preparing a request for a formal hearing before the board. Mondo told friends he didn't want any part of it. Even if he won a long-shot pardon, it would not exonerate him, he told them. It would just forgive him for a crime still attributed to him. I didn't do this crime. The only way I want out of this place is for them to admit I was an innocent person," Rice said, according to Buddy Hogan, a longtime friend. And Buddy Hogan said, "That's not how a guilty man talks," right? So he had finally, in just, you know, in the past week or so, said, "Okay, go ahead," you know, like right before he died, "but only if it says that I was wrongfully convicted." So, you know, he stood to his principles to the end, you know, which is something all our freedom fighters do. And, you know, very admirable. I mean, you would prefer to die in prison than to be outside with, you're still being considered guilty of a crime you didn't commit. I mean, that is pretty amazing human being, right? Just to mention. I mean, you know, I visit prisoners, so I can tell you they are all amazing human beings. So, as we've all been saying, you know, it's very sad, but, and, you know, it makes me feel in a way like I'm a failure, but now we have to pick up the work. As Safia always said, you know, now we got to redouble the work to get everybody else out. So, you know, here in New York State, as I've been saying, we have 5 people going to the board in this period. I know that Herman is going in this month. I'm not sure exactly when. So So that's very soon. Maliki's going in April. Madrid is going at some point if they ever resolve that Article 78. And both Jaleel and Seth are going in June. Now, Seth has been, as most people know, you know, in the past year or so, he has gotten very ill. He lost a lot of weight. He only weighed 129 pounds. You know, it's maybe, what, 10 pounds more than what I weigh. And, you know, had been very sick. Now has developed congestive heart failure in addition to diabetes. He did receive treatment for the Hep C, which he no longer has. We're grateful for that. But he has this congestive heart failure. I just spoke with him. He called me the other day, Saturday morning, I believe, before I got the Mondo news, or I would have told him. And he's saying, once again, his sugars are getting very low. So, once again, that's a concern. So we really, really want to get him out of there this year. He's going to the board in June. We're going to work on a plan B. Maybe we can target something to the governor, you know, about him being so ill and he should be let go and so on and so forth, you know. But meanwhile, people, please take a minute to sign the damn petition. Excuse me, but that's the way I feel about it. You know, I have these two petitions out there. One is for Jaleel. One is for Seth. That only takes a minute to do. These guys have been in prison for 45 years. You know, their entire lives have been spent in prison. They have sacrificed, as Ralph said earlier, for all of us. And it's not about them. It's about us, as Larry Pinckney was just saying. That is absolutely true. If we fail to do this, then what future are we leaving for our children and their children and their children? You know, we really have to bring everybody home now, because in the middle of this, you know, whatever the farce, which I totally agree with too, of selections, you know, where nobody's even talking about issues, you know, if any of these people become the president, it's going to be that much worse for our political prisoners and for all of us. You know, I mean, it's blatant fascism, and it's amazing. But I just wanted to take a little time. I won't take long, because I have been working on a project that Jaleel nicely gave to me to do, and he wants to put it out there about the 13th Amendment. So back in 1979, he and a couple of other brothers presented this whole, it's an extremely interesting historical document about the 13th Amendment, prison slavery, violation of international laws. I'll be putting it up on his website. Hopefully later tonight. If not, it will definitely be up tomorrow. That's freejaleel.com. But he wrote an intro, which is short. So I just wanted to read the intro. The 13th Amendment, Prison Slavery and Mass Incarceration. Since the publication of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, the issue of prison and parole reform has been raised as far as Obama's White House. In the national debate ensuing from Michelle Alexander's book, some have not given credit to Angela Davis forging national interest in prison abolition with her organizing critical resistance campaigns across the country. With the nominal success of the Pelican Bay prisoners' hunger strike in California, we recognize that when we organize a national determination, we can collectively force institutional change. With the advent of the Black Lives Matter movement, there is a new generation of activists who have included the challenge to mass incarceration as part of their national debate and agenda for institutional change. However, it is extremely important that the Black Lives, what he calls BLM, for Black Lives Matter, and other prison parole reform advocates have a profound historical foundation in their understanding of the prison industrial complex. In my recent book, Escaping the Prison, Fade to Black, I included an essay, The 13th Amendment, Prison Slavery and Mass Incarceration, hoping to offer more insight on how to formulate talking points to persuade others, particularly faith-based communities, to join and advocate for change. This struggle is not new to me. In fact, my frustration is that it is often necessary to repeat and reiterate the need for a national determination that actually challenges the very foundation of the institution of prison slavery. In this regard, I am offering a legal argument that two other former prisoners and I prepared and fought in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and including petitioning the United Nations, stating the exception clause in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is in violation of international law and U.S. treaties with the United Nations and the international community. On November 19, 1979, I and two other former prisoners filed a civil rights complaint in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, alleging that the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is in violation of international law and general principles of human rights. The complaint was docketed as 79 CIV 6228 and sent to Federal Judge Pierce for consideration. Copies of the complaint were sent to various legal groups and organizations such as the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, American Civil Liberties Union, etc., in an effort to win their support for the petition. Unfortunately, they declined to respond to our overtures to support this case by providing legal representation. As novice pro se litigants, we pursued the complaint to the best of our abilities, ultimately being denied cert by the U.S. Supreme Court. We then sought to win the attention of the United Nations subcommittees to no avail. It was obvious to us then, as it should be to activists today, that without a serious national organizational determination, it was improbable for us to win. However, we were adherent to the principle of Frederick Douglass that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. And our audacious attitude was what we needed to challenge a system of prison slavery, no matter how implausible the possibility of success. In 2016, it is believed that the potential exists to build the kind of national and international campaign to demand the 13th Amendment be amended to excise and omit the clause that permits involuntary servitude and slavery of prisoners. Therefore, I am posting the memorandum of law that we prepared in 1979, as I believe it provides today's activists and advocates for prison parole reform both a historical and legal foundation to build a substantial movement to once and for all end all forms of involuntary servitude and slavery in the United States. It is my sincere hope this document will be widely read and studied, especially by law students, professors, and legal groups involved and associated with prison parole reform advocacy. My aspiration is to offer the overall movement broader talking points to persuade and evolve an informed national campaign capable of organizing a durable prison slavery abolition movement. Certainly the Black Lives Matter movement, Critical Resistance, Jericho Amnesty Movement, etc., can achieve more in the educational agitprop determinations with this information as part of their pamphlets, brochures, and other outreach materials, including social media posting. I firmly believe there cannot be any significant discussion about prison parole reform absent a challenge to the very foundation of the prison slave system. The economic and racial implications of prison involuntary servitude and slavery are based on the historical reality of African chattel slavery. Who can deny that the slavery abolition battles that resulted in the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment were incomplete and are unfinished business? Remember, we are our own liberators. Respectfully submitted, Jalil A. Muntakim, Apartheid Attica. Okay? So that's just something that is a little long and wordy, but, you know, the brief itself or the memorandum of law, which I have been retyping because it doesn't exist anywhere and it was a bad photocopy of a bad photocopy, is done. So I am going to be putting it up on freejalil.com along with that intro. People should definitely look for it in this week coming. And hopefully we'll get it up tonight, but it might be, you know, tomorrow morning. And it's something really interesting. It has a lot of really historical facts, some of which I didn't know at all, that at some point during the Civil War, some army people had actually ceded a whole bunch of land in the South to African slaves. And that was something that is a basis, I would assume, for what is now, you know, the RNA and so on and so forth. So more than just the 40 acres and a mule that were promised, this was actual land that was given to them in the South and then taken away, you know, later on. But he and his comrades, who are both out now, they make this really compelling argument. And unfortunately, of course, it didn't, you know, get the support at the time. But certainly we can put it out there again as a point of discussion for people because it is very important, you know, because these people weren't making all this money on these prisons, they wouldn't be keeping so many people in prison. And, you know, they have the equivalent of the population of some countries in prison in this country. You know, what is it, more than 2.5 million people who are in prison? I mean, that's just amazing. That boggles the mind. That's like more people than live in Nicaragua. You know, you're like, that's a country. You know, you're like, wow, you know, we could take everybody in our country and put them in a prison, and we would be barely the same as the United States. You know,
yes.
It boggles,
well, thank you so much for those facts, Ann. One of the things that you must realize, I'm sure you do, that Lynn and I and Betty are part of organizing to get a lawyer for every political prisoner.
Yes,
to
know,
make sure no one goes before the board without a lawyer. We're working on that, and we're also working on lawyers so that they can include a defense committee, the people who can go to the people to take these issues, as you have described, to the people. And so, yes, we're working on it, and I would say that you must be, I don't know how you do it, because you have visited so many political prisoners. I have been negligent. I get letters from political prisoners, and I was reading some letters this evening that are breaking my heart, because so many people believe that Obama was going to do something for our political prisoners.
No,
and
I never thought he would.
Ralph, you're running out of time.
Right.
Please, you know, from the bottom of my heart, get out there, influence the electorate, because as Leonard feels, that if Obama leaves the office without pardoning him, he will die in prison, where there are many who feel the same.
Yes,
our
they do.
Misleaders have told people that electing Obama was important for the people. We must make it so because of their faith. I have no faith, but I tell you, after reading the letters that I received tonight from political prisoners and those who are not political, those who have been unjustly incarcerated, they're saying, Ralph, redouble your efforts. And the one that breaks my heart when they say, you did it for Lynn, do it for us. And it makes me, you know, want to go out. And let me continue.
I know what you mean.
You must be hurting because you see these people face to face.
But I can tell you they are some of the most amazing people. I mean, that's part of what inspires me to do what I do, because to me they're like family. You know, so like these are some of the most amazing people you could ever meet in your life, and I have been honored and privileged to meet many of them, including the Move women, who are fantastic. You know, and you know they're also coming up for parole in May, so there's a whole campaign going on for them as well, and for whatever umpteen time it is that they're coming to the board for a crime of which everybody knows they never committed that crime and that they're innocent, and none of the Move 9 ever committed that crime. And, you know, we have to continue to forge on because of their inspiration. You know, I mean, they inspire me. I mean, if I was sitting in prison all these years, would I be able to be that together and that, you know?
I know you are, and I say thank you again for that. Continue to keep
you,
up.
Thank you, Ralph.
We have Mary and Richie are waiting to comment on this, and we hear it. And so let me go to Richie. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Ralph. How are you doing?
Okay, tell us what you think of the discussion so far, and
hang
in there, Mary.
I wanted to say thank you so much for helping Avril Hernandez, our anarchist comrade, political prisoner in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He said he's trying to work with the lawyers you're trying to get for him in Texas to try and get them to reach out to him, because he says he has new evidence that can get him out immediately. He just needs a lawyer to help him with that. And stealing his mail, but I keep sending the information because I told him, I did give you his letter. I gave a copy to Ramona Affert, and I said, I did a follow-up letter I'm going to mail that say, I'm in touch with Ralph. He's trying as hard as he can to get some type of lawyers in Texas to work with you and to visit you. And
I
the
was
problem
say,
is he has, he's in this horrible prison, you know?
We are working on getting lawyers from around the country for the list that we are going to promulgate to have a lawyer for all of the people who are
regularly on
it.
Well,
so
he's an amazing person because...
He really is. He is an amazing person.
I write to him, and he writes me the most militant anarchist letters I've gotten next to me or the Move people.
Right.
He doesn't care if they read his letter. He doesn't care what they do to him, he's going to do what he does. And I wanted to read at least what he says in his letters, because next to Mamiya and the Moo people, and they're all great, but because I'm an anarchist, it's kind of extra special to me. He always writes to me, smash the fascist police state.
Yes.
Free all PLW political prisoners in the USA. No surrender, buried alive in this torture dungeon. Fighting back on all fronts against the state-sponsored terrorism and capitalist dehumanization. And he writes on, my brother, I apologize for not writing any sooner, but I have been very busy with my outreach work. Yes, some of your materials were again denied, but I did get your letter. He's an amazing writer. I'm urging him to write a book. I think he's just as good as Mamiya, and he has Hep C, and he's on a waiting list to get the Hep C. What I don't understand is, I know how Mamiya got the Hep C, because they gave him bad blood in the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how a lot of these other political prisoners go in healthy and get all these Hep C problems and all this high blood pressure. I know that a lot of that's from the food, but there's something going on in these prisons that they're killing them systematically with these Hep C diseases, because they don't go in there with Hep C. And
well,
I think we need to protest the AMA and the whole medical community that they're allowing murder, medical murder.
Right.
Yes, but and so therefore we call them death camps, because this...
That's what he says, too.
Okay. And but assure him that there are no people of conscience out here who are dragging their feet. We are all...
Oh, I tell him that, yeah.
Too
well,
few of
work.
Us. And Yaron, assure him that those letters that you pass on to me will be passed on to a lawyer as soon as we get him in Texas. And as a matter of fact, Lynn and I are leaving town again to go to a group of lawyers in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Next week, to enlist lawyers, young people who are coming out of schools, law schools in the Northeast. And we are still reaching out to lawyers down in the area of Texas, but you know, when you talk about Texas and Atlanta, Georgia, you're talking about, hard to say. I don't have a word for what they are, historical slave states, Louisiana,
yep.
Mississippi,
yeah.
Murderous places. And we are speaking out to the best of our ability to enlist people, lawyers, to take the risk. And as so many people have told us as we travel, so many young women have said, Lynn Stewart, I wanted to meet you because I heard you speak, and I decided to become a lawyer, and I decided to be a lawyer just like you. Well, there
That's
is
great.
Hope. And I, you know, I tell people, yes, but form a defense committee to protect yourself. Join so that people can come and protect you, because when you speak justice in this evil country, then you, the speaker of justice, become the enemy. As Lynn Stewart, of course, now I cannot say that. Lynn Stewart was the enemy for her activism for 50 years on behalf of the people, and only a part of those 50 years, 30 years, she was as an attorney. I'm going to turn this over to Betty, as we will continue with our struggle to free those of us who have fought so hard on our behalf.
One of the things I'm hoping, and I thank you, Brother Ralph Winter, is that Brother Larry will be able to give us some recommendations and strategies over the air regarding jailhouse lawyerism in the future. But I want to remind you again to call Governor Rick Snyder, 517-373-3400. Tell him to restore Reverend Pinckney's phone access. Call Director Heidi Washington, 517-241-7238. Again, Director Heidi Washington, 517-241-7238. Speak with her or her assistant. Sandy Simon and demand no more solitary confinement punishments for Reverend Pinckney or any of the other prisoners under her command. Without further ado, we want to have Sister Mary give us a few words before we turn the mic back over to Brother Ralph or anyone else who has closing comments. Sister Mary Neal, are you in the house?
Yes, thank you, Miss Betty. I really appreciate it. Hello, Mr. Ralph. I want you to know, speaking of solitary confinement, the ACLU settled a lawsuit with Indiana, and Indiana has agreed that mentally ill inmates will not be in solitary confinement for more than 30 days. They will not be confined for more than 30-day stretches. Now, my question to ACLU in celebrating this good news is, how many days, weeks, or months must a mentally ill person be out of solitary confinement before they can be re-sent to the hole? The thing is, it's fine to say they can't be there for more than 30 days, but can they come out on the 30th day and go back in on the first of the month? And you see what I'm saying. Then we
very astute thinking, Mary. Very astute of you to ask that question.
Well, absolutely. And then last week, the ACLU filed another lawsuit against the Pennsylvania Department of Health for the long wait time for inmates to be transferred to a psychiatric hospital after they were found incompetent to stand trial. You know, a lot of judges and juries are more astute now also, Mr. Pointer, and they are finding people incompetent to stand trial, but in Pennsylvania's case, they're simply keeping them in jail. And so that is wrong. And the third thing and the last thing is a good news for everybody. The Justice Department discouraged state court systems from jailing criminal defendants who failed to pay fines or fees. A letter was sent Monday to state court administrators, and it warns that judges must consider alternatives to jail for poor defendants who don't pay their fines. And it says defendants shouldn't be locked up without the court first determining that the failure to pay was willful. The guidance is aimed at curbing practices that the Justice Department says run afoul of the Constitution. So we may see less debtors' prisons because of fines and fees. A great many people are paroled or put on probation, and then they have those probationary and parole fees. And so the Justice Department is now discouraging the state court systems from jailing criminal defendants on that basis. And so those are three good news reports if they really are followed and if the prisons and jails don't get around the 30-day limit by letting people out for a day or two and then putting them right back again. So I thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Mary Neal. I'm Director of Assistance to the Incarcerated Mentally Ill, who comprise 1.25 million of the 2.3 million people behind bars right now.
Well, thank you so much for that, Mary. And I'm going to switch back and see if Lynn is ready with that little nursery rhyme of 1750. Are you there, Lynn?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Read it loud and clear.
Okay, let me just read it out, and we'll close on that note, I guess, or whatever you want to do, Ralph and Betty.
Yes, read, please.
Okay, here's this nursery rhyme from 1764, before the American Revolution. They hang the man and flog the woman that steal the goose from off the common, but let the greater villain loose that steal the common from the goose. The law demands that we atone when we take things we do not own, but leaves the lords and ladies fine who take things that are yours and mine.
Thanks, Lynn. Good night.
Be amazing.
Good night, my pleasure.
Wonderful. Wonderful. See you all next time.
Say all the things that I should say. Say them.